Right, thanks very much. Okay, so is this too loud or is that fine? Or? That's fine? Okay. So what I'm going to do is to go back to the holographic superconductors, which Chris introduced to us in the first week of this conference. And so he gave a very nice review of the breakthrough which led to this construction of a holographic superconductor. And in his setting, the setting he considered, one of the settings he considered was a charged scalar in Einstein-Maxwell gravity, which leads to an instability, which condenses to a new ground state, which has properties of a superconductor. And so, as Chris mentioned, there is actually different versions of these holographic superconductors around. And in addition to a scalar condensing, there's also the case of a current dual to a gate field condensing, which then leads to a particular kind of P-wave superconductor. And he also showed us some examples, and so the examples which have been studied so far most of the time actually are in ADS-4 space, so we have a four-dimensional gravity theory here. Okay, so this nice work leads to a couple of follow-up questions, which I would like to discuss with you here. So the question is, if there's this holographic superconductor which has the following properties. So one thing which would be very nice is to actually know the field theory explicitly, which is involved in the dual field theory in the superconducting setup, in the sense that you can actually write down the Lagrangian and determine the elementary fields which enter your superconducting condensate. So this is one question which we ask ourselves. And the other one, which is actually related to this, is it possible to realize such a holographic superconductor within 10-dimensional type 2b supergravity as it comes from a low energy limit of string theory, and so really to embed these superconductors into the 10-dimensional context. So, and these questions I'm going to address in this talk. And so we found some answers to them. I would like to show them to you. So we found a holographic superconductor in 3 plus 1 dimensions. So the field theory is in 3 plus 1 dimensions. And it has the following properties. Well, first of all, the dual field theory is indeed explicitly known, and I'm going to show it to you. And also, there's a at least qualitative 10-dimensional string theory picture of the condensation mechanism, which I would also like to show to you. And if you would like to read more, then you can look at these two papers which I wrote with my students. I should also mention that we indeed have a P-wave superconductor in the sense which I just mentioned on the first transparency. Okay, so how do we actually achieve this holographic superconductivity which these properties are mentioned? Well, we go back to this context of adding flavor to gauge gravity duality, which Andreas introduced to us on Friday. And so the first part of the talk will be with reviewing some of the aspects of this adding flavor to see how then later the superconductivity emerges in this context. Okay, so just very quickly, one feature of the NXT4 super young Lattice theory, which is involved in the standard version of ADS-CFT involving ADS-5 and S-5, is that all fields are in the adjoint representation of the gauge group, which is as follows. And of course, there was pretty soon after the discovery of ADS-CFT the wish to extend the duality to some theories which are closer to QCD, closer to the real world. And then you actually need some quark degrees of freedom, but in QCD, these quark degrees of freedom actually transform in the fundamental representation of the gauge group, as you can see here. And such fields don't occur in the original version of ADS-CFT. So one needs something additional in this context, and this additional bit is given by these so-called brain probes, which Andreas already discussed. So if we add these brain probes, as I'm going to show to you in a few minutes, then we add fundamental degrees of freedom in the dual field theory in a way I'm going to show. So So if you are not familiar with brain so far, let me just say that at this stage, these are additional hyperplanes which will be embedded into this 10-dimensional space, which is IDS 5 times S5, or to make things more physical, more interesting for applications, we also embed these hyperplanes in deformed versions of this space. Okay, and so this context of ADS-CFT with flavor has led to a whole area of research in applying ADS-CFT like techniques to theories which are closer to QCD. And so there's many phenomenological aspects which can be studied. One is of which is to consider fluctuations of these extra hyper surfaces or brain probes, and this actually leads to meson spectra. Then, as I mentioned, you can embed these brain probes into deformed versions of the original ADS 5 times S5 space, and especially into 10-dimensional backgrounds, which are dual to confining gauge theories. And one physical feature which you obtain in this way is chiral symmetry breaking for given by quark bilinears. And still another application is to put these brain probes in the ADS black hole geometry, which was mentioned a lot during this conference. And this means that quarks will then be added to the finite temperature field theory. And there's also a huge area of research studying these scenarios. And you can also turn on chemical potentials for either the baryon density, or as I show you later, it will be very important here for the isospin degrees of freedom. And so these are generally obtained from a non-trivial value for the time component of the gauge field on the gravity side, in the way I'm going to show. And so this has all been an intense study and leads to a rich phase structure, in particular these two aspects here where you turn on a finite temperature and also a finite density. And this has been studied by many people, and also, of course, people who are here. And maybe I should mention first Andreas Karch and Rob Myers, but also Hong Liu and Pierre Kraus, who've been involved in studying these scenarios. Okay, so this introduction brings me now to the outline of my talk. I'm first going to describe how to add these flavor degrees of freedom to gauge gravity duality. So by gauge gravity, I mean it's some generalization of the original ADS-CFT correspondence pairs, conformal symmetry and supersymmetry can be broken in particular ways. And I will give you some of the results about holographic quarks at finite temperature and density, because those will be provide the setup in which we will then study the superconductivity. And I'll show you how the superconductivity arises. So that's the plan. Okay, so first let me take you to the string theory origin of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So I think this is an aspect of ADS-CFT which wasn't touched upon so much during this workshop yet, but it's very, very important. And so the question is, so where does ADS-CFT come from? And of course, it's a scenario which arises within 10-dimensional supergravity as a low energy minimum of string theory. Sorry, is there some water somewhere here? Sorry. Not very much, so I won't go very far. Okay, this will last for 5 more minutes. I hope Sean comes back. Ah, wonderful. Okay. Oh, yeah. I think you will have to get another one. Okay, let's try. So, ADS-CFT correspondence in its original form arises from considering D3 brains in 10-dimensional string theory. And as such, the correspondence actually originates from the fact that these D3 brains have two different interpretations within the context of string theory. So in one hand side, they are hyperplanes on which open strings, which are depicted here, can end. And as such, they provide a higher energy completion of quantum field theories in some sense. So these open strings, they are associated with matter degrees of freedom. And on the other hand, these same D3 brains, which are these open strings providing a possibility for boundary conditions on these open strings, they also have an interpretation as being solitonic objects in supergravity. And so they are, as such, they are very massive objects, and they curve the space around them and provide a curved space. And now in this particular example we are discussing here, if we look at particular low energy limits, then in these fields, in this field theory side low energy limit, this setup actually reduces to the NX equals to 4 super young mass theory, which has been described quite a bit already here. But on the other hand, the curved space, which is generated by these very heavy solitonic objects, actually is of the structure ADS5 times S5 in a particular limit, the so-called near horizon limit, which also amounts to a low energy limit. And the origin of the ADS-CFT correspondence, or the idea of Maldacena originally, was to conjecture a duality between these two different properties of these three brains, or these two different interpretations of these three brains in the 10-dimensional context. I think this is also something very important to emphasize in the context of this workshop. So the low energy limit of this interpretation gives us our N equals to 4 super young Mach theory. And so here the excitations are open strings. And on the other hand, the low energy limit in the setups here gives us supergravity on the space ADS5 times S5. So low energy limit means we go to such low energies that the strings actually appear point-like. That's why we get a gravity theory. And the excitation here in the gravity theory are closed strings. So really, ADS-CFT is an open closed string duality. Okay. And this is pretty essential for introducing quarks, which now, again, are fundamental fields in the field theory. And so we have to have strings now which also begin on these D3 brains, but they can end on something else to actually ensure that we only get this fundamental representation. And the easiest way to do this is by adding a so-called D7 brain probe. So here I've drawn the zero, this is our time and our space directions, and the D3 brain will stretch in these directions here, so the N-D3 brains, which correspond to our large engaged theory. And then we put a D7 brain probe, well, at the beginning we just put one, later we put two, and this will be in these directions, which I have drawn here. So we have two coordinates which we have to specify the position of the D7 brain. But we also see that there's a U1 symmetry in these two directions here. So here's a cartoon of what's happening. So this is a cartoon of the ADS5 space, this is the S5. And the D7 brain is this blue object, so it fills the way it wraps in view of preserving a maximal amount of supersymmetry. It will fill all of this ADS space, but then it also will wrap an S3 inside this S5 space. And so it can actually fluctuate here, which will give rise to these Mason eigenmodes. So this is the radial direction of the ADS space, and I should also mention that depending on the value of the quark mass, which is the boundary condition on the D7 brain, this brain can stretch all the way as drawn here, but it can also end at some finite position along the radial direction. And this is important too in the follows. Okay, so let me now take you through this slightly more detailed picture of what's going to happen. So here we have a 10-dimensional or 9+1 dimensional space. So the 0, 1, 2, 3 direction go up, 4, 5, 6, 7 go to the right, and 8 and 9 point towards you. And so this string theory version of the correspondence which I've shown you here, now it appears in this graph as these black lines here. And this is the field theory side, this is the gravity side. So the the duality which I showed you previously is between these green open strings here and the closed strings in the ADS space. So this blue disk here on this side now corresponds to this ADS5 space, and I haven't drawn this here just for space reasons, but you also have to imagine this here, of course, as well. So the standard ADS-CFT correspondence is between these open strings here and the closed strings in the ADS5 tensor spice space. Now we add something on top, which are these probe brains, and we take NF of them, but NF should be small, actually. So, and this will wrap so a blue rectangle, or I mean this plane of the slide. And here now we can define our quark degrees of freedom as strings which begin or on the D3 brain, but they end on the D7 brain, for instance. And so so these strings are charged, and here this symmetry which is here then will correspond to the flavor symmetry. And then if we take this same limit we took in the first version or the standard version of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which involves taking n to infinity as well as the TUF coupling being large, then actually the following picture emerges. So in this talk I'm going to keep the number of flavor brains small, and this leads to the so-called probe approximation. And this approximation, this gauge coupling here, this eight-dimensional gauge coupling becomes small or vanishes, and then I can view this as a global symmetry. And so this global symmetry is going to be my flavor symmetry in the problem. And then now the additional conjecture of this additional correspondence, which we have on top of the original one, which is due to Andreas Karch and Avi Katz, is that these degrees of freedom, they will be actually dual to open strings on this gravity side of the correspondence. And actually, this will be described by the fluctuations of this probe brain, the hypersurface in the 10-dimensional space, as given by these open strings. So the following picture emerges. We have our standard NX24 super Young Mist theory, which is dual to type 2B supergravity on ADS5 times 5. And now we couple this to an additional hypermultiplet in the fundamental representation of the gauge group. And these degrees of freedom, they will be described by the action describing the probe brain, so the hypersurface. And this is the so-called Dirac one infinite action. Yes, that's right. Yes, okay, it's a little more subtle than that. So in this particular limit which we take, we will look again. So as always in ADS-CFT, we look at gauge invariant operators in the field theory. So I'm going to have four-dimensional gauge invariant bilinear operators, like psi bar psi, for instance, or so. And this psi bar psi will then be mapped to some fluctuations of this hyperplane in this higher dimensional space. I'm going to explain more. So, okay, so during this conference, we have always used this effective model of just four or five dimensional spaces, and we looked at some physics there, and we never worried about the actual structure of the strings. So this was just to indicate where it comes from, but then we will take the same limit as before, so we work with the supergravity approximation, and we work with point-like objects. And so the same dualities which you had before will happen now. So you're going to map some gauge invariant operators to some fluctuations of this hypersurface. Okay, so the important point is this Dirac one infinite action, which tells you how the brain, this hypersurface is actually embedded into this 10-dimensional space. And so the configuration will be such that the equations of motion for this action are satisfied, such that this action is extremized. And so here, for the D7 brain, you see the structure of this action. So this is related to the tension of the brain. And here we have the pullback of the metric to the world volume of this eight-dimensional hypersurface. And then here it will be crucial later on that we are actually going to charge. So these D brains are charged, and this will be essential here for our setup. So there will be a gauge field also on these brains. Now, an important point which Andreas already mentioned was that all the contributions which are going to appear here will be of order nf over nc, so they will be of order n compared to the n squared of the background. Okay, so we are always considering effects in the background of the standard alias CFT correspondence. And another important point is that our field theory, since it starts with this against the supersymmetric setup, will involve fundamental fermions as well as scalars. So we have fermions, we add fermions as well as scalars in the fundamental representations, and again, these bosons, they will have important effects on the physics again. Okay, so now we combine this idea of putting quarks via a probe brain with the great gravity duality at finer temperature, as we did already quite a lot during this workshop. So here you see again the 10-dimensional version of the ADS black hole. So this is the 5-dimensional ADS black hole space, sorry, including this, of course, and then we add the this 5-sphere on top. So we really have a 10-dimensional space here. And as before, the temperature and the horizon are related by this relation here. So R is the ADS radius. Okay, so now let's put these probe brains in this well-known background. And so when we do that, actually something very interesting can happen. So so this is again now a cartoon of my 5-dimensional ADS space, which now has this black hole inside. And now there's two possibilities, depending on the boundary conditions which you put on this D7 brain, which, so the boundary conditions in fact determine the quark mass and the quark condensate. And either this brain can actually end before it reaches the black hole, or it can go all the way to the black hole. And there's actually an interesting geometrical phase transition associated with this behavior, and which turns out to be first order. And so I'm going to show, so this was a simple picture of what's going to happen. So let me show you a more elaborated one just shortly because it's relevant later on. So the same picture as I showed you before in some other coordinates now looks like this. So this coordinate W6 is one of the coordinates, say this X8 coordinate here. And the rho coordinate which turns up is the square of these four coordinates here. So in some sense, it, the sum of the two will be the sum of the square of the two will be the square of the ADS radius. So, sorry, I'm going in the wrong direction. Okay, so basically, the black hole appears as this. Okay, there's some square root 2 factor somewhere. So this modulo of a scale of square root 2, this is a sphere, so this is the horizon of our black hole. And so now we can have, these are the D7 brains, so the hyperplanes which we embed. And so either they actually stop before reaching the horizon, this means they go here, or they actually end on the horizon. And which behavior they have is determined by the boundary conditions, and in particular, the value at the boundary here of the ADS space. Is given by the quark mass. So I should emphasize there's only one scale here in the problem, which is the temperature, so all dimensionful quantities are normalized to the temperature. And so there's this interesting phase transition here when the brains go from ending before the horizon to actually ending on the horizon. And so here we can see this phase transition here, and this is the condensate, the quark bilinear, which is given by the second, so the leading term is the quark mass, the next to leading term is the condensate here in the asymptotic behavior. So the boundary conditions are very similar to what happens in standard ADS CFT. And if we plot the condensate versus the quark mass, we see a particular shape, but the interesting region is this region here. And if we zoom in this region, we actually see a first order phase transition. So this nice geometrical phase transition has also a nice interpretation in the finite temperature field theory. Okay, now, as I told you, these D7 brains which are embedded, they are also associated to mesons, and the mesons are given by the fluctuation modes of these brains. And so now there's a standard procedure for calculating the meson masses. And in fact, they're calculated from the linearized fluctuations of this D7 brain. So we look at a particular ansatz for the fluctuations. So there's some function depending on this radial variable rho. And then there's a plane wave ansatz here in this form. And so this is inserted into the linearized equation of motion. And so now the interesting point is that for black hole embeddings, so for those embeddings which reach the black hole, omega develops a negative imaginary part, and this means there will be some damping, and the, actually these measures can decay. So going back to this graph, so the fluctuations here, they will just give a spectrum of delta peaks, because there's no dissipation, but the fluctuations of the brains here, energy here can now dissipate into the black hole, and this will generate this decay width for the mesons. Okay, and so this picture can also now be brought in contact with the study of spectral functions in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence, because we can identify the mesons with the resonances in the spectral function. And as was already discussed here, the spectral function is determined by the poles of the retarded green function, and in this black hole context, these poles are related to the so-called quasi-normal modes. And the same structure can also be applied in this context here. Okay, so now we're slowly making our way towards the superconducting state I want to show to you, but there's still some more ingredients which we have to put in. So the next one is to turn on a finite chemical potential in a finite density. And so here first I'm showing the more simple case that you just put one single D7 brain probe. And so you have an extra U1 baryon symmetry. And now you can turn on a chemical potential for this particular symmetry. So this was first introduced by Rob Meyer, Sunji Matsumura, or considered by Rob Meyer, Sunji Matsumura, and David Matoyos, and I think there were some other people. I'm just quoting the result here. Okay, so now you obtain the baryon density and a chemical potential for this U1 baryon symmetry from looking at a VEF and a sub-leading term for the gate field time component. And so here the leading term will, in this time component on the of the gauge field, remember now this is the gauge field which appears in this Dirac-Bohn infeld action. So it's not some gauge field which appears in the supergravity background. It's really this baryon symmetry associated with these extra quarks which we put in. And so here the leading term is the chemical potential, and the sub-leading term then is the density associated with the symmetry. And so we have is our baryonic density. So lambda is the TUF coupling, this is the temperature and the number of flavors. Here, so at the moment I'm considering mostly the case of just one flavor. So and as these authors found, they saw an interesting change to these embeddings, which I just showed to you. And in particular, at finite baryon density, all the embeddings are going to be black hole embeddings. So already previously, they were the ones which were ending on this black hole. But now also those which used to be Minkowski embeddings, so they actually terminated before reaching the black hole, they now develop this spike, and they also now become black hole embeddings. And this is related to the fact that now we turn on a charge on these brains, and so there will be some fundamental strings stretching from these brains to the black hole. So there's a quite significant change in the geometry. Yes, yes, that's right. So it's just for any arbitrary small value of the charge, you get this behavior. Okay, so now we have introduced both a temperature and a finite density, and of course one can also study a phase diagram. And okay, let me just explain to you the simple structure of this diagram. So here's the temperature and here's this baryon chemical potential. Both of them are normalized to the quark mass with some extra factors of lambda and NF in this side. And basically now the phase diagram is such that in this region, this baryon density vanishes, and so there's still a crossover phase transition, the first order phase transition I showed you between the Minkowski and the black hole embeddings, but in this region here, in the white region, the density will be non-zero, and then there's still a small region where there's still a first order phase transition between these black hole embeddings, but if you move out, it just becomes a crossover. Okay, so there's some interesting structure here in this phase diagram. Okay, so now let me make the next step towards our superconducting states. So what I showed you so far was a U1 baryon chemical potential and density. And now what we're going to do is actually to look at an isospin chemical potential and density. This means we now put two brains, 2D7 brains on top of each other into this ADS Rothschild black hole background. So again, then we look at the gauge fields in this Dirac-Bond infeld action. And here, if you look at the algebra, it now splits into this U1 baryon part, which I showed you already, and then there's an SU2 isospin part. And so here the advantage is now that the operators which you can consider, they will actually be charged under the symmetry, so then there will be a much more interesting structure possible, and that's actually what we're going to see here. Now, of course, there's a price which we pay, so if we want a more interesting structure, this also means that the calculations become more complicated. And this definitely happens here, because if we put two brains on top of each other, then we have to use so-called non-abelian DBI action to describe the D7 brain. And so there's some technicalities involved about how to do this. And I have a slide about this, but I'm deferring it slightly further into the talk, but I definitely mentioned a few aspects of the calculation. I think, but it's really important to remember that there's some tricky issues about this. Okay, so but now if we turn on a finite isospin density, what do we do? So we choose the time component and the three direction in flavor space to be non-zero. So we pick the components which involves the tau 3 sigma matrix, which has 1 minus 1 on the diagonal. And then by picking this direction in flavor space, we explicitly break our symmetry to a remaining U1 3 symmetry. So we have this SU2 in flavor space, then we pick one direction, and then only the rotations around this direction remain. Okay, so this is the symmetry which later will be spontaneously broken and given the superconducting ground state. Okay, so I promise you that we can write down the Lagrangian for our field theory. I'm not going to do it because it's pretty long. But at least I can tell you exactly which fundamental degrees of freedom are inside this field theory. So we start in the background again with NX24 super young Lewis. But now we put two flavors of fundamental matter in this hypermultiplet. Okay, so there's 2D7 brains corresponding to hypermultiplets of NX22 supersymmetry. And then we turn on finite temperature, which breaks the supersymmetry completely. And we turn on this finite isospin density. So this is our model, and where we will have these superconducting states. Okay. And so now we see something interesting. So we first looked at finding the same phase diagram as I showed you for the baryonic case. And in principle, the structure is very similar. So there's this region here where the density vanishes, where these delta peaks appear in the spectrum, and we have stable mesons. And again, there's a phase of black hole embeddings where the mesons melt. But when we studied this phase diagram, we realized that actually a new phase arises in this region of the diagram. And so first, we were very puzzled about this new phase because it's actually unstable. So what is unstable about this phase? Yes, but I'll come there in about 5 slides, so. Okay, well, maybe actually I'm already there. Well, yeah, I'm getting there. So there's a new solution. Sorry, I wanted to say something else. Oops, I think I lost a slide. That's okay. Let me just draw what I wanted to say at this point. So first, I have to explain to you why is this getting unstable. So let me just draw this one slide, which I forgot to put in my. How do I get this? Sorry. Yeah, just okay. Thanks. Okay. So the slide I wanted to show you, which I forgot to put there, was if I look at the complex omega plane, and so now I study the different fluctuation modes in this new phase, then there's one fluctuation mode, say A3, which fluctuates along this isospin direction, which I switched on. And then there's two, A1 plus A2 and I1 minus A2, which are the perpendicular fluctuations. And so if I look at this graph now, Yes. So if I turn up the density, this mode in this graph actually moves like this, and it stops here at zero. So basically, this mode becomes a massless meson, which is a kind of room meson condensate, as I wrote up there. But these modes, what they do is they go here, but then after going into this green phase, so here I'm cranking up the density, so I'm going somewhere in this direction, crossing this green line, and they will actually move to the upper half plane. And this means that my modes grow up exponentially, and then something's really unstable about this phase. Okay, thanks. Sorry. Okay, so this new phase is unstable, and there these modes which cross into the upper half plane. But then we discovered that we can actually find a new solution. And well, this was, so we were puzzled for a while about this unstable phase, but this was just the moment when the paper by Gupta and Kufu appeared, where they discussed this P-wave superconductor. And then we said, okay, this is the same thing we are going to find here. There's now a new solution to the equations of motion where we have a non-zero wave for the A31 sigma 1 component in addition to the non-zero A03 sigma 3. So the lower index is the space-time index and the upper one is the flavor index. So it's perpendicular in flavor space, but also it corresponds to a current because it has a space index, and this has a time index. Okay, so and as we find from the equations of motion, so as an input, we put this finite chemical potential here. Remember, so this is an isospin space. And then the subleading term has this isospin density here. And then we find a new solution, and the key point is that there's no constant term here. The constant term vanishes, and there's immediately this subleading term here. And this is very nice because this means that we have a spontaneous breaking of the symmetry because this corresponds to a condensate rather than to an explicit breaking. So we are sure that we have a spontaneous symmetry breaking here. And now the pole structure is much nicer to what I have drawn there on the blackboard. So as before, this is the A3 mode which converges to zero. But now these flavor diagonal modes, they do not cross this axis anymore. So this is the lowest one, also converges to zero, but the other ones turn around and asymptote to the axis. So everything happens in the lower half plane, and so this instability is gone. So this is very nice and gives some feeling that indeed this state is stable. I should say right away, I mean, so far what I'm telling you is only about the gauge degrees of freedom, but of course there will also be scalar degrees of freedom. And they are very hard to study in this non-abelian theory. But I can tell you that we checked a few of them, and they actually condense at a higher density than this rho meson. So it's a bit different in QCD. So the vector meson condenses before the pi, which is a bit counterintuitive. But since we started a different model, this can certainly happen. Okay, so, and now this new ground state has properties known from superconductors, and which we then studied in some detail. In particular, we have an infinite DC conductivity, we have a gap in the AC conductivity. We can show that our phase transition is second order, and so we have a critical exponent of 1/2. And I'm also going to show you a remnant of the Meissner-Oxenfeld effect. Okay, so it's a remnant because the symmetry which we break spontaneously is actually a global symmetry. So really what I've shown you so far is a superfluid and not a superconductor. But nevertheless, I mean, there's quite a few properties which are similar to superconductors. Okay, so first let me show you the order parameter. So the order parameter is this vector condensate. So this is a space index and we have this current. And then you see also the flavor structure. So I labeled these with U and G for the two flavors. And then of course I have to stress that we also have bosons around in this model. And as I showed to you, it's due to this particular component of the current. Okay, and as I said, so really what we found is a flavor superfluid because we have a spontaneous breaking by a global U1 symmetry. But by a procedure very similar to what Sean, Chris, and Gary discussed, by using a weak gauging, just introducing a small gauge coupling for this U1, we can also construct a superconductor. Remember that this is this flavor symmetry, which is in the background of the SUN color field theory. Okay. Okay, so now I have a few graphs to show you. First of all, here's the order parameter, so this P wave condensate. And so here this is the T over TC and the condensate. And so now we studied this for various parameters. Here, one is for vanishing quark mass, the other for finite quark mass, and there's not much difference. Okay, so here we fitted this line here to see that we get a critical exponent of 1/2. So there's some numerical error, but it's pretty small. Another important point is that we cannot really go to zero temperature in our model, because we are in this probe approximation, and actually you see here already this starts to diverge, which is a little strange, but this is because we neglect the back reaction of the D7 brain on the geometry. So if we would not take that into account, hopefully this would converge to a finite value. But here we clearly see the limitations of this probe approximation also. Okay. So, I mean, it's really less that, I mean, the number of degrees of freedom will, so although it's NF over NC, the density can become, I mean, of order NC, I mean, the effect will be of order NC squared, and so that's what we see here. Okay, so then to confirm the stability, we calculated the grand potential versus the temperature, and here I just drawn the flavor contribution, and so this is the superconducting state, and this is the other state, and so as desired, so our state is the more stable one of the two. And here there's another interesting thing, is the flavor contribution to the heat capacity. So here you see the T over TC and the heat capacity divided by T cubed. So this is the superconducting state, and this is the normal conducting state. And divided by T cubed, you see here, you see it seems to be constant. So we have a behavior proportional to T cubed, and so this is what you expect for bosons. So the bosons in our model, they definitely win here again. But what is also interesting, so here the exponent seems to be bigger than 3. So remember that Andreas told you on Friday about this T to the 6th behavior. I'm not sure this is T to the 6th, but certainly it's more than TQ. And so here it appears that this unnatural T to the 6th behavior actually is unstable and decays to a standard bosonic ground state. So this is at least what we seem to see here. Sorry? No, it's just the flavor contribution. The total contribution will be positive. Okay, that's why I wrote flavor contribution, because it's negative. Okay. Okay, so of course the nicest thing about a superconductor is to calculate the conductivity, and so here you see a very nice plot of the frequency-dependent conductivity. So this is a plot for vanishing quark mass, and so this factor omega here is normalized in such a way. And so we have the real part of the AC frequency conductivity here. There is a so we start with a black line at for the normal state. So this is the normal state. Then at the phase transition, we see here a delta peak begins to form at zero frequency, and then we have this kind of pseudo gap where it doesn't go all the way down. And then if we go further down, a really nice gap forms. There's also again this delta peak, which now you can't see anymore in this graph. And so this is 0.5 TC. And then for 0.28 TC, we see a really nice pronounced peak. And then we see these additional wiggles. And so these actually are the higher resonances of the mesons in the fluctuation spectrum. And well, so okay, this is the gap, and this is the lowest meson mode, if you want to know. Because so the this conductivity is the spectral function divided by the frequency. So it's basically I'm plotting the retarded green function divided by the frequency, and before we were talking about the fluctuations of this probe brain in the background, and that can of course have higher modes. So it's just the fluctuations of this probe brain. Yeah, I mean, if you want, you can expand. If the S3 is still present, we can expand in higher modes on the S3. You know. Yes. Okay, I mean the lowest mode is the, okay, it seems to be pretty stable. I mean, you have to remember in the normal phase also we saw this mode moving to zero, there was this condensation phase. So maybe it's a remnant of that. But here I think I was more focusing on these wiggles, which are these higher modes of the meson. And I think it's interesting you see them here, and I think if I'm not misled from the point of view of condensed matter physics, this is interesting, and maybe the condensed matter people can tell me better. Apparently in some condensed, in strongly coupled superconductors, you can also see such additional things. But, well, it's the spectral function for this particular mode which I've been discussing. Well, no, this is also parallel to the common phase. Yeah, it's the main. I mean, the sigma 3 mode. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. No, sorry. Okay. No, this is this fluctuation for the A1, I think. No, sorry. Yeah. It's this U13 which is broken. Yeah. Yeah.
So he's asking what direction would be applied electric field, right? So if you have a vector condensated, yeah, matter apply electric field in the direction of the vector condensated perpendicular to the right.
Yeah, yeah. So there's the flavor direction. So there's this U13, this is in the flavor space. And now he's asking if my current is it's from this A1 fluctuation, so it must be the A1 direction. Sorry, I'm a little confused, but I look it up for you, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. Yeah, I the paper is in my bag after the talk, I pick it and take. Sorry about that. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to, well, some of the graphs I wanted to show you is, I want to show you some remnant of the Meissner effect. And this we can see if we turn on a magnetic field. And since our symmetry is global, then we don't really actually see London equation, all these things, but we see the two different fates. We see the fact that this magnetic field actually kills the superconducting phase. So here's the temperature and the magnetic field. So here in this region, the magnetic field and the condensate coexist. And so the condensate is this A1. So this space, so the space component and the sigma 1 component in flavor space. And so in the upper phase, the condensate vanishes. So that's quite nice. And okay, so I wanted to make a few remarks about the fact that we use this non-abelian GVI action. And so we have to calculate this, you know, for having our isospin symmetry. And it's pretty non-trivial because now we have different components of so in SU2, so there's different Pauli matrices. And so actually we have to be careful because the non-abelian DBI is not really well defined in curve space backgrounds. And so we have used two different methods and basically found that we get the same physics in the one and in the other, except that in one the graph looks much nicer. So I showed you the ones with the nicer looking graphs. And so one is we expanded the action to fourth order. And the other one, we use the so-called modified symmetry trace prescription. And so basically, we use a simplification and omit some of the commutators of these Pauli matrices. And of course, if you omit things, there's an error. And in principle, as Rob Myers showed already some years back, there's an error of order 1 over nf. And of course, in our case, nf is 2, so in principle, this can be big. And nevertheless, this method has some nice features because it allows for an all-order calculation of this non-abelian GVI, so we don't have to expand. And so it seems to be capturing the physics quite well because the graphs are much more pronounced than in this expansion to fourth order. Nevertheless, it's reassuring that the main features of everything I showed you appears in the two calculations. So you say just look at the order f squared terms. Yes, of course. Yes, that you can do. So for instance, there's this paper by Basu, Shi, and people from Vancouver, and they do something very similar than we did, but they just use the trace f squared approximation, and they cannot see these additional higher peaks. So this you can only capture. No. Okay, so I think this is the essential difference between the two. This is the modified symmetrized trace prescription. Yeah. And I mean, in the fourth order expansion, this peak, you can see it becomes somehow like this, and this one becomes very tiny. But you can still see them, but they're not as nice as here. But also maybe this peak then is not so pronounced. It's a little washed out in the other movement. Okay. So, but another thing I promised you was the stringy picture of what's actually going on here. And I think, so we don't have a quantitative analysis, but at least the qualitative picture is quite nice. So here, this is again this rho direction which corresponds to the radial direction of the ADS space, and here you see the green and the blue plane are the two descending brains which we have. And X3 is the direction in which our current points here. So so as before in this picture, which I showed you for the U1 baryonic density, first we have strings which stretch between these brains and the horizon. So these brains are pulled all the way to the horizon and they touch the horizon. So we have these black hole embeddings. And so we have these horizon strings which go from the D7 brain to the black hole. And these strings actually, they induce a charge near the horizon. So but now what we actually observe is that the system becomes unstable above a critical charge density. And so what appears to happen is that these horizon strings, they actually recombine into these seven strings, and they leave the horizon, they move out. So the boundary would be somewhere up here. So they leave the horizon and they propagate back into the wild. And so they then stop at some equilibrium position where these various flavor electric forces and the gravitational force, the attraction from the black hole, actually balance each other. And so they are at some finite distance from the horizon in the bulk. And so we see that actually these 77 strings, they distribute the isospin charge into the bulk, and as such you can interpret them as forming the superconducting condensate. And so I think this is quite nice in this model that now we can really have a stringy picture of what's happening in the holographic superconductor. And okay, so this is the same picture once again, just to show what's happening. So this is the time component and the three direction isospin. So this is our background field, and this is its conjugate momentum. And this is the field which spontaneously breaks the remaining U1 symmetry, and this is its conjugate momentum. And so blue is the normal phase, and red is the superconducting phase. So there's a boundary condition here that this should vanish at the horizon. So here's the horizon. And then this asymptotes to the chemical potential here at the boundary. And here the associated momentum can be interpreted as a measure for the isospin charge density. And so you see in the normal phase, the isospin density is the same everywhere in radial direction. But then in the superconducting phase, we see there is a depletion near the horizon, and the charge seems to be moving out in this direction here. And so here, this is the field which spontaneously breaks the U1-3 symmetry, and this has to vanish at the boundary because we want a spontaneous breaking. And but on the other hand here, this now you can interpret as the density measure for these 77 strings. So here at the boundary, it asymptotes to the condensate. And then again, you see they move away from the horizon in this area here. So here, this analysis gives some indication that this picture, which we found here, makes sense. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's my conclusion and outlook. So we found a holographic superconductor for which the field theory is explicitly known. And so it's our first explicit example of superconductivity, or to be more precise, superfluidity from a 10-dimensional action. And so the key ingredient is that we embed two coincident T7 brains and then get isospin density. And this non-abelian structure is essential for seeing this mechanism happen, because then we have these charged fields around. Okay, so what would be the obvious things to do next? Well, one obvious thing would be to look also at the fermions in the system, although I should emphasize that we definitely have the bosons around here, so they will certainly also enter the game, but nevertheless it would be interesting to see what fermion-like operators do in this context. And something else I looked at with Elena Kasovic when I was here in Santa Barbara was to actually study space-time dependent solutions of our equations of motion. So this means we let the condensate oscillate in spatial directions. And actually we found another type of solutions which are not superconducting, but they're rather more like spin density waves, which was quite interesting. And so we are about to study the characteristics of those now. Okay, so thank you very much. Yeah. So you mean some kind of fixed mechanism or... Yeah. Well, okay, in some sense it's similar. So definitely I think we should have a Goldstone boson here somewhere hidden, which probably refers to the rotation at infinity of our U1 symmetry. inside the gauge field. And but okay, I think one point would be to really identify which are exactly the Goldstone bosons and how do they relate to the gauge symmetry. And but something along this line, I think, is happening here. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next thing is to dig out the conductivity function. Yeah. Well, okay, so now if we, in the equations of motion, we allow for a space-time dependence, then we get a wave vector which is given by the chemical potential. And so there's two different kinds of solutions. I mean, the superconducting solutions, they just get a tail and they just have an exponential fall-off. But there's some other solutions which are not superconducting, which just get a e to the ikx space-time dependence in them. Yeah, it's nonlinear, but you can actually around. So if you expand around the critical point, you can factor off the space dependent part. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So this is a good point, and this was also already mentioned by Chris. So. So we have this P wave state, so which is a vector state, but at the same time it's a current, so there's a current pointing in a particular direction. And so I think there's two answers possible to this question. So one is the same answer as Andreas gave on Friday, is that we are looking at these degrees of freedom in the background of all the color degrees of freedom. So we have this reservoir of energy, which, you remember Andreas was saying, we are pumping energy into our system, but we have this reservoir from the background fields which are there, so the color fields which are there. So this is a possible source of energy for this current. Another thing is that perhaps, you know, looking at the space-time dependence, we could find something like more like a standing wave, and that would also be nicer. So this is something we are looking at. Yes, in the way it is set up right now, yes. Yeah.